I'm going to try to tie this all together, and I also work, as you heard from Meredith, for Health Alliance International, so you're going to see an eerie similarity between my slides and James's slides. I'll try to go really quickly so you don't notice it, and so we have more time for questions. But I think some of the stuff bears repeating because I don't think we really talk about these relationships very often in our field of international public health. And I think that, you know, forgive me if I'm a little repetitive, but I think that to make these connections, it might be worth being a little repetitive. So. So just to kind of tie together what Rick was what everybody was talking about, trying to tie all that together, what Rick was talking about in the context, how that really relates to what NGOs do and what NGOs have been, I'm having the same problem. Let me see. First of all, I want the slideshow, right? Okay, and then, what was it, right here? Okay, good. So the context in which we all work as NGOs is something we don't really think about. It's kind of like the air we breathe, right? And so we don't think about it very often. And so, it's worth noting that we're working in a context where public investment in developing countries has really dropped precipitously from its peak in the early 80s. And why did that spending decline? Well, Rick was talking about some of those reasons. SAPs are structural adjustment programs which penalize public infrastructure projects, including health and education that Rick was talking about. Controversies about aid to the public sector and feelings about governments are corrupt and we can't trust governments to really spend this money, but somehow we can trust NGOs to spend this money with very little evidence that that's actually true. IMF conditionalities that Rick talked about, and theories about the predatory state. So fears that confidence that the private sector would compensate for a drop in public investment that we saw in the earlier slide, and also a fear that the public system would crowd out private enterprise. And most recently, interestingly to me, we saw this argument used by George Bush in his defense of his S-CHIP veto, that, you know, we wouldn't want a public health insurance program to discourage private or to prevent private insurance from providing insurance to those folks. And that same argument is used internationally to defend not funding public systems. But what really happened? Well, the private sector did not fully compensate for the drop in public investment. In fact, the IMF, a sort of quasi-independent evaluation body of the IMF in recent research showed that the private sector did not compensate for the drop in public investment as was hoped. Report of Commission for Africa, again, you know, just it didn't happen. And the effect of structural adjustments on programs on healthcare over the years has been really devastating, and James talked about some of this, but decreased quality of health services, less money for drugs, fuel, and supervision, greater reliance also based on urging from the World Bank on service fees and user fees, decreased utilization as a result, but people who can't afford to pay those user fees don't show up, an inadequate workforce, eroding salaries, low morale, and the health impact has been difficult to measure, but a leveling off of decreases in mortality rate has been related to this trend, this phenomenon. And just to show you, some of the areas of the world that are most affected by these structural adjustment programs are those tiny little dots, and the dots represent, the size of the dots represent the levels of health expenditure, and on the left side is the percent of the global burden of disease. So those areas of the world that have the highest burden of disease have the lowest amount of health expenditure, and the lowest percent of the global workforce, health workforce, is working in those countries. And I would say that that's related to those other trends. So in this place where the public infrastructure is eroded, donors have turned to NGOs as a more efficient, less corrupt way to provide health services. And the World Bank itself, that played a role in these structural adjustment programs and in weakening the state, from a 2002 report, says when the state is weak or not interested, civil society and the social capital it engenders can be a crucial provider of informal social insurance and can facilitate economic development. The interesting thing here is the World Bank doesn't mention why the state might be weak or not interested or point it back at its own policies that created that situation in the first place. But NGOs, this is the slide that's the same as James, so I won't repeat it, but NGOs have proliferated in response to the huge amount of donor funding available because of this trend. And a lot of this is our numbers that James already went over. The only additional thing here is the number of international NGOs supported by USAID increased from 18 in 1970 to 195 in 2000. So in PEPFAR itself, again, this reiterates some of the things that James was saying, has a huge dependence on NGOs for delivery. 16% overall of PEPFAR money goes to governments, and 84% overall goes to NGOs and U.S. universities and other private institutions. And then I'll get the next slide talks about the Phantom Aid, which actually Rick's group, ActionAid, has done a lot of great, I would refer you to a great report, which you can find, I'm sure, on the ActionAid website on Phantom Aid, Real Aid on that, if you want to know more about the amount of aid that funnels back into the rich countries through by U.S. policies, or you know, European countries do this too, required purchases of FDA-approved and branded drugs. And it's also difficult to fund salaries, recurrent costs, and other needs within the public system because of PEPFAR regulations. And this is just a kind of graphic slide of that. So where does the money really go? The money goes into the U.S., the non-governmental organizations, and how does it come out? A lot of it comes out in indirect costs and high staff salaries and staff support. Expats need nice cars and nice houses and nice offices working in these poor countries. And relatively little of it goes to direct service delivery. Some of it goes to local NGOs, and very little of it goes back to ministries of health. So the Mozambique example, which is you know where all of us the folks who work for HAI have worked, this huge proliferation of NGOs creates a big management burden. There's over 200 health NGOs in Mozambique in 2005 with 150 separate sites of operation in 10 or 20 program categories, with each having its own independent planning cycle, donor requirements, implementation style, and each relying on their donors' priorities, which are all over the board. So graphically, what does that look like? Here's bilateral donor support in Tanzania, 2000-2002, and each of these countries have their own projects. So Switzerland, with 29.7 million, only has 5 projects. You can see the big bands of color there. Where you go all the way down to the bottom, Ireland, with about the same amount of money, has 404 different projects that they're separately funding. And that creates a huge management burden for the ministries of health. So this is the commodity logistics system in Kenya at the Ministry of Health, okay? So again, this is where I put my hat on as the public health director for the Cleveland Department of Health and think, oh my God, if you had to be in the Ministry of Health and manage this thing, would you really want to show up to work every morning? I mean, so you can see the, we're focusing a little bit on NGOs. You can look at this color right here represents the NGOs that are in this picture. But there's a lot of other folks in this picture, too. There are government agencies, World Bank, bilateral donors, and multilateral donors. So you can see WHO, UNICEF is here. So the U.S. government is here. So depending on what kind of commodity contraceptives, and this is just, health drugs. I mean, this is just one little area of the government and of the health ministry, for that matter. So contraceptives, condoms, drugs for STDs, essential drugs, vaccines, tuberculosis drugs, et cetera, and you get the picture. And the source of funds, the procurement body, the warehousing, who delivers it, and who's responsible to deliver it at sub-district levels. Very, very complicated. It's really kind of impossible to get your hands around this, especially when you consider that ministries of health severely underfunded and understaffed in terms of their management capacity. So how are they possibly going to keep tabs on all that? James talked about the problems of vertical program and the funders' reliance on really funding more vertical programs, diverting sources away from primary care. Fashionable diseases have priority. Right now we're really seeing a lot of consternation amongst the people who are concerned, for example, about maternal mortality or family planning. That used to be more fashionable a few years ago, but people seem to have forgotten about that. Oh, maybe we don't need family planning anymore? I don't know. But things, you know, fall into favor or out of favor and get more funding or less funding, really having very little to do about what a big burden they are to public health and more to do with what donors are interested in at the time. Workers pulled away from those programs to work in the fashionable programs, the vertically funded programs, and internal brain drain is another problem with these vertical programs to NGOs to work in these programs. And this is a graphic slide kind of showing how donor funding drives that. There's an article by Fitzhugh Mullen called White Follows Green, an essay on White Follows Green, White Coats Follow the Green. And the green lines here are where the money goes, and the white arrows are the healthcare staff that leave the Ministry of Health to follow the higher salary jobs in the NGOs, and even in local and country organizations, and of course also external brain drain is a problem going to wealthier countries. This, you already saw this slide. I fixed the thing on the edge. So I won't go into that. But just assert my PowerPoint superiority. But in terms of sustainability questions, which I think the previous slide also speaks to, in Mozambique, there was a war in Mozambique, which ended in the early 90s. And in the early 90s, you know, post-war, post-conflict, come rebuild the system. There was great interest by donors in coming to Mozambique and helping rebuild the health system. So there was a lot of folks funding programs there. And so in 1994, this is kind of a terrible slide, but the gist is, in 1994, all those groups were working in Mozambique, and by 1998, the ones that are highlighted in yellow had left. So again, weakening the public health system can be, we heard examples from James and Donna about how NGOs can be good actors, and I come up here to kind of show the dark underbelly of NGOs, and how some of the actions of NGOs, even the unintended practices of NGOs, can weaken the public health system by channeling resources and staff towards NGOs and away from the public sector, the creation of parallel systems, inequity in service delivery, increased management burden. Who are they accountable to? International NGOs are not accountable to anyone. The expats, they're essentially working in countries where they're not accountable to any of the elected government, and you know that they sort of operate in this sort of weird space. Sustainability issues, and often relying also on unpaid volunteers, which has effects on the labor market in the countries where they're working as well. So the problems that NGOs face is how can we promote equality while still retaining our advantage? And what we're proposing is a code of conduct to help NGOs that are interested in really following the examples that Donna and James laid out for us, and we've thought about, and both you can see Health Alliance International and Partners in Health, along with ActionAid, Physicians for Human Rights, HealthGap, Oxfam UK, and Equinet have had a role in developing a code of conduct draft that I'll share with you some elements to help guide these good practices and help us avoid some of the pitfalls. So the code of conduct would cover hiring practices to ensure long-term health sustainability, to limit NGOs hiring from local systems and mitigate this internal brain drain, support improved public sector conditions to encourage workers to stay in the public sector. NGOs would pledge to enact employee compensation practices that strengthen the public sector by limiting pay inequity and supporting better pay for public employees, also providing compensation for community health workers. NGOs would pledge to create and maintain human resources training and support systems that are good for countries where they work as far as training, especially paying attention to pre-service training and training for the broad categories of public health, including management as well as clinical training. There's a lot of emphasis in short course clinical training. We'll teach you how to do PMTCT if you're a nurse, or we'll teach you how to prescribe antiretrovirals to kids. But less emphasis on this pre-service training and on training that really creates a stronger overall healthcare system. NGOs pledge to minimize the NGO management burden by committing to joint planning and limiting parallel structures. Pledge to support the Ministry of Health as they engage with communities to integrate them, the communities, into the formal health systems, and embrace their role in supporting the public sector through advocacy and promotion. And just a couple of slides on some of those advocacy points, which again have been almost all of them mentioned in previous talks. Support nations to develop plans for comprehensive primary health care and sort of resist this vertical pressure from the donors. Advocate with donors to provide resources to primary health care and health system strengthening instead of vertical programs. And advocate for ministries of finance and planning to expand health sector budgets and workforce within countries. As Rick was talking about, working with ActionAid to advocate on removing IMF and World Bank constraints and reduce dependence on international financial institutions. Advocate for debt cancellation. And also really try to creatively push for alternative models of aid, untied aid basket funding to go to ministries of health to put the aid in a common basket where ministries of health can plan overall for the whole health system rather than having that slide I showed you of Tanzania with all those different projects. Support nationally defined rather than externally defined needs and increase direct support for governments. And that's it. I think I finished good. Okay, so we have good lots of time for questions.
Okay, thank you, Wendy. That there is information about this idea of a code of conduct and also what Rick spoke about. That is on the back, the chairs on the back. There may still be information unless it's all been taken, and there's also some information up here at the front, in the front. There's also a sign-up sheet that has gone around. I don't know if anybody has seen it. Can raise your hand. Okay. So if you'd like to get more information about this, please add your name and email. We can make sure that we get that to you. And there are also evaluation forms. That the woman who spoke with me before, Miho, is she still here with the evaluation forms? Yes, in the back. Okay, so if you could fill out an evaluation at the very end, that's something that the International Health Section is doing, so that would be great. All right, lots of time for questions. So with your questions, if you could let us know if it's a question for the whole panel or first one person specifically, and also what your name is, and we're going to try and finish up at 4 o'clock. So, yes.
Seth Foley from Milwaukee. First to Rick, nothing you said seemed to make any sense unless maybe they're trying to drive, you know, human services into the private sector. It might make sense.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think part of the reasons are that I think there's a couple things going on all at the same time. One is that some people would say the privatization is being driven by chronic underfunding that happens first, and then even public health services, public education, utilities, water is a huge issue too. Those utilities and public services are being forced to privatize because of chronic sustained underfunding over a long period of time. I think there's something to that dynamic. I think the problem with the two policies I was talking about in particular at IMF, the deficit reduction and the inflation reduction, and perhaps the unwarranted degree of restrictiveness really is what we're concerned with about those two policies, really stems from a philosophy. It's sort of like an ideological mindset of the people that believe in that. When Reagan and Thatcher came into power in the early 1980s, they really overhauled the staff at the World Bank and the IMF. They kicked out the traditional Keynesian economists who had been there, who were really in charge of helping rebuild Europe after World War II in the 50s and 60s into the 70s and so forth. And then they were replaced with sort of the free trade, free market people called the neoliberal economists. And that school of thought has really become dominant over the last 20, 25 years. But there's a subset of those neoliberal economists that are called monetarists. And the monetarists have sort of like a school of thought in economics that believes very strongly that inflation and deficit should be very, very low. And you see, at the time, that seemed like the right approach because they were sort of responding to these huge economic crises that were plaguing many developing countries at the time, the late 70s, early 80s. So at the time, it sort of seemed like the appropriate medicine for the crises at the time. But what's happened is when those policies were first introduced, they were understood to be one, you know, very conservative, but one of many options that countries could adopt. And what's happened over the last 20 years or so is that people have forgotten about the other options. And like if you look at people, the way they teach economics today or like development studies today, this monetarist policy approach is really perceived as the one and only option. And that's sort of a huge problem, which is why we're trying to get the health advocacy groups to work with the economists to understand that that's really only one of many options to be considered. So.
Okay, next question. We've got a bunch right here in the orange shirt. If you could stand up and say your name and...
Stages, and I'll take this opportunity to say there is a flyer back there about a meeting on Thursday, but I will warn you that it's in a small room and it's just about full, and so if you're interested in going, call to RSVP the number or that's on there, but we probably only have two or three spots left, so it's on Thursday kind of 9 to noon, but that meeting is actually calling together a group, a kind of a larger group of NGOs to talk about a final draft, getting a final draft of this code. We've sort of, these NGOs, this core group has put together this draft. And we would, one of the things that we envision is that donors or governments would take this code and use it and adapt it themselves and say, and many governments have done this. Mozambique, for example, has done this and requires NGOs that work in Mozambique to sign a code of conduct basically talking about how they're going to work together, follow ministry priorities, contribute to the health system, et cetera. And we use some elements of that code in designing what we've designed. So we hope that governments will take it up and use it and kind of be strong against the NGOs that come in and say they want to do their own things.
Okay. Next question right here. Did people in the back hear that question?
No.
Okay. The question is about, it's directed toward Wendy, and others can comment if they would like as well. It is about the credibility of governments and the concern about corruption and whether or not the organizations or the people who are here are working on that or know of efforts that are underway.
The first thing is I would just want to, I really want to see the evidence on government versus NGO corruption before we start making blanket statements that governments are corrupt and NGOs are pristine. Because that seems to be the sort of paradigm that we're operating under, is that, you know, you can't trust governments, but somehow you can trust NGOs. And I have not seen that study. Maybe it exists somewhere, but I don't know about it. So that's my first reaction, is that certainly, you know, there are, you know, we can find corruption in government, we can find corruption in NGOs, we can find corruption in our own government, in the governments of rich countries. But if you Google the phrase corrupt African government or corrupt African government official, which I have done, you get like 50,000 hits. And if you Google the phrase, you know, corrupt European government, you do not get 50,000 hits. I did this a while ago, so I don't remember how many hits, but not that many, very, very few. And or, you know, U.S. government even, you don't get that many hits. So, you know, I think there's a stereotype that we have to kind of worry about here along those lines. The second thing about corruption that should be deconstructed is it's a two-way street. So there's the people kind of accepting, you know, there's the people in the government that might be not spending the money correctly, that might be doing whatever, you know, pocketing money, whatever. But there's the other people, and some of those people work for NGOs that, or are, you know, based in NGOs that are sort of encouraging that corruption, or, you know, oil companies or things like that. I mean, there was a great article several years ago in The Nation about, you know, our vice president's participation in corruption in Nigeria for offering bribes, Halliburton offering bribes to the Nigerian government. So there's two sides of corruption too. So let's think about it that way. Okay, so even given all that, let's assume about a corrupt government and say, well, what do we do when we have a corrupt government? Well, even in that case, I would say that we can't escape what everybody at this in the panel was talking about, which is we really cannot provide quality health services to an entire country based on either a private sector or an NGO project-by-project level. So you have to somehow engage the public sector. And, you know, there can be an array of different strategies for that, I think. And you know, I'm not somebody who works in these fields. I think ActionAid also works on some of these things. But, you know, in working with governments to both address the issues of corruption and build the public sector simultaneously, I think, is one solution. So.
Okay. I think Rick is also going to comment on that.
No, I mean, it is a hugely important question. It's a really good question. I agree with what Wendy just said. I think it's there's a lot of stereotypes going on. It was interesting, just last week at the World Bank annual meetings, we saw this playing out. There was a colleague from Oxfam International on the panel, and he was talking to healthcare. He was talking about healthcare workers and doctors and nurses who are currently staying in their jobs as heroes. And it was really interesting because he's talking about how, you know, the adverse working conditions they're working in, the low pay they're getting, the frustration, the inability to do their jobs well, with the lack of administrative support that they're faced with every day, and yet that they still keep showing up and they're committed to doing their jobs. And he was looking at the glass half full and saying what heroes these people actually are. Same thing for the public education system. And yet we had a guy in the audience in the World Bank who's saying, well, we've done studies that show X number of them don't even show up for their jobs, or they show up drunk, or what about all these ghost workers on the payrolls, you know, like why don't the health ministries clean out these jobs? These people aren't even existing, and yet these salaries are going to somebody each month. And so it was a really interesting dialogue back and forth, because you had these, you know, two really different perspectives on this issue going back and forth. To combat corruption, ActionAid does a few different things in many different countries. We've got a budget monitoring team. We do budget analysis work, which means every year when the budget is read, we look at how much is going to education and health and small farmers. Is it more or less than last year? If it's less or if it's not enough, we engage in advocacy with the media, with the parliaments, with the government on trying to get more for health and so forth. We are very big supporters of the Abuja Declaration, which is a commitment by African governments to put in 15% of their annual budgets towards health. We do that budget analysis work. We also do budget tracking work, which is kind of anti-corruption work. We see how much money is supposed to be in the health ministry this year, how much is supposed to go to the district governments, how much it goes down to the local levels, and we try to track that money. And we also constantly are demanding greater transparency in order to do that budget tracking work effectively. Something that's really inspiring to us is that, you know, after the 1970s Watergate scandal here, we developed something in the United States called the Freedom of Information Act, and called the FOIA, F-O-I-A, and that's where U.S. citizens can sue the government to get documents disclosed. Well, it may shock you to know the number of countries that have actually adopted similar legislation in just the last 10 years has more than tripled. It's gone up over like 70 countries today have this, and the law just got up through the upper house of parliament in Nigeria, which we thought it would be stuck in for forever. Now the president won't sign it, but that's like the next thing. But it just goes to show that everywhere there is this trend, this important trend, where citizens are increasingly intending on holding their governments to account. Just last thing I would say real quickly, ActionAid did, we did actually sort of fall into this role of trying to be a service provider for a while, particularly in education. We had a lot of experience like building schools and that kind of thing for a long time. And about 10 years ago, we started really being more introspective about that and sort of seeing, you know, what is really being acknowledged here today, that we were sort of almost complicit in this whole agenda of underfunding and rolling back the public sector from being able to do its thing. And we were sort of going along being a little crutch or a prop for the insufficient funding of the state. And we sort of realized that we shouldn't be doing that, and ActionAid is really committed to what they call a rights-based approach to economic development. And that's where we tell citizens, we're like, look, here's what's in your own constitution. Here's the treaties, you know, Convention on the Rights of the Child, Economic and Social Cultural Rights Convention that your government has signed on to. Here's the things your government is obligated to be doing. You should be mobilizing politically yourselves, domestically, to call on your governments to adequately fund public health and education. And that's a whole different, more political approach that we've been committed to taking. And really backing away from this sort of fiction, as I think Wendy put it, that this idea that NGOs can sort of step in and ever really replace a fully functioning, well-staffed, effective public sector investment that these countries really need over many years. Thanks.
Okay. Wow. More hands have gone up. All right. Question in the back. You've had your hand up.
But I think that it's also really important that we don't go away.
society may have heard, but concern about romanticizing governments or international NGOs, and that it's a difficult and complex reality. And I certainly can respond by saying that, you know, my work in Guatemala, it's certainly not been the best government in looking out for people's interests. Anybody like to comment on that? Donna?
I can't say too much to that point. I agree with you. I just wanted to bring up a point from the panel that I was just moderating on the last session, where we might want to, I'm going to propose this to my colleagues here working on the Code of Conduct, we might want to look at something more of a rights-based sort of evaluation of what we're trying to do with this Code of Conduct or something, because Ali Yaman just gave a terrific presentation on how they're assessing the Peruvian government on their attempts to, or well, their lack of response to the maternal mortality rates in their country and the inequities that exist in their country with the health system. And I think that we might want to actually try to take something like that along with what we're doing, or complement one another to look into some of these issues and to address some of these bigger inequity issues that exist on a ministerial or a government level. So that's all I'm saying.
Okay. Question here, in the gentleman in the front.
Quickly, it's kind of a complicated question about what they call basket funding, but in Mozambique and other countries in Africa, there's something called a sector-wide approach to planning, called a swap process, and many countries have developed this where major donors, usually bilateral donors, usually European countries, who get together with the ministry and they jointly manage the donor funding with the ministry so that they're jointly planning, and it's certainly a step in the right direction. Now, there's some complaints that it's still kind of puts the donors in the driver's seat, not the ministry, but it's certainly a real step ahead from where things were, at least in Mozambique in the early 90s. Just a little anecdote about that. A Mozambican friend of ours who used to work in the Ministry of Health said that apparently the Europeans call themselves the like-minded donors. That's a term you hear all the time, of the ones that are together, say, let's put our money into the basket, let's work together with the ministry in planning this. The United States doesn't put any money into the basket, and they're called the single-minded donor. But very important question, a very important kind of mechanism that has been very helpful in coordinating planning. So it's moving in the right, at least in our experience, but that still doesn't put the ministry fully in the driver's seat. I'll turn it over to Rick to talk about the other.
The answer to your question is yes and no, or yes and not enough. There are people inside, especially the World Bank, who definitely understand exactly what I'm talking about here today. And there's even people inside the IMF, Sanjeev Gupta, Andy Berg, there are people there who also recognize that perhaps the fiscal and monetary policies have been a bit too restrictive. But you see, the real problem is that you're sort of dealing with an ideological mindset. You're talking about a group of people who believe sincere, you know, sincerely believe what they're doing is best. And it's a bit like a Hindu trying to convert a Muslim into Hinduism out on the street corner, right? You're not going to get very far. It's like you can bring forth all the research you want, and it's not going to get you very far. It's really sort of like a mindset problem, and it's really going to take political pressure to resolve it. So what we're really talking about is challenging those maxims or those precepts of monetarism, which would say deficits and inflation must be so low, and to really say, look, there's this whole other body of empirical evidence which suggests they don't need to be that low, and what are the real implications for properly investing in health systems over successive years of these somewhat more expansionary alternatives, which are supported by the research, but which would contravene this sort of dominant mindset right now. That's the real sort of problem. And so, and people did fight against these monetarist ideas in the 80s when they were first implemented, and they lost. They fought against them in the 90s, and they lost. But what's different about today is that there's these two things that are sort of coming, heading for a collision. It's the desire on the part of the world to fight HIV/AIDS effectively, and the desire of this particular group of monetarists to keep these monetarist policies intact. And this is like a train wreck that's going to happen sooner or later, because there's no way you can fight HIV/AIDS effectively under these monetarist policies. And that's just the sort of inherent contradiction that's coming. Because and one of the biggest things is not just the brain drain issue of getting more wages for health personnel, but really if you look at like what happened to the health budgets in the 1980s under the first adjustment loans, the original stabilization loans of the IMF, there were big budget cutbacks, it's true, and there were huge layoffs. But also there's like a part of the budget that goes for recurrent wages, and then there's a part of the budget that goes for the long-term capital expenditures. Those are the long-term investments as a percent of GDP that go into the underlying health foundation, the system, the hard infrastructure, the bricks and mortar, but also the administrative support, the professional administrators as well. And all that took big budget cuts back in the 80s, and it's never been replaced. It's been chronically underfunded ever since. So that's why it's not just a matter of wages. It's a matter of big public investment as a percent of GDP. They say public investment. And like scaling that up over successive years. Unless they do that, and they start now, there's no way you're going to fight HIV/AIDS. So, I mean, I don't know if it's going to take 3 years or 6 years or 9 years or 15 years for this to get through people's heads. But when the world makes a real commitment to do what it takes to fight HIV/AIDS effectively, the first door they're going to have to walk through is this fiscal and monetary policy.